This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamotu, MPR. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Stu Schwartz.
Alison Milden.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Okay, now Stu, you did you set up or you took over the Taylor Jensen Gallery?
No, we created the Taylor Jensen Gallery from scratch. After I left the employ of the city council, and they paid me a little bit out, which was very nice. I basically goofed off for a year, traveled, deciding what we're going to do with the future. But a good friend of mine who had done framing for us and became a fast friend, Dennis Jensen, sitting around deciding, you know, what I should do. Dennis always had a gallery outside his framing shop where he showed art. He said, what this city needs to be truly cosmopolitan is a picture gallery, is a real working live gallery showing, promoting local artists of all sorts. And I said, well, I certainly could do that. He said he knew of a place that probably would be ideal because a friend of his had this building and they were basically just working on the inside, dressing it up. So I went to see it, and I said, this would work perfectly. And basically in June 1997, talked to the bank, put together a funding package and a plan, and Dennis and I put together Taylor Jensen Fine Arts. Now, Jensen, of course, honors Dennis Jensen, who was the original partner. Mm-hmm. Taylor is a family name because doing some research, the name Schwartz Jensen is even hard for me to say, mm-hmm. and certainly mm-hmm. hard for New Zealanders. So I look back on the arty side of my family, and the name Taylor sticks out. And so we chose the name Taylor Jensen Fine Arts. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to work well. It sounded really highfalutin. Could have been a lawyer's office, you know. Yeah, deciding on the name and that sort of thing took a little while, but we ran with that. And we took over the space in June of 1997 and outfitted the gallery, contacted the artists that we were interested in, sent letters to lots of artists throughout the region. And on the 1st of August, 1997, Friday night, we had a big party for all the movers and shakers in town, et cetera, et cetera, and officially declared Taylor Jensen Fine Arts in business. And the next day, a Saturday morning, we opened to the public, and the rest is history. We had 22 years before I retired, and when and if we reopen with a new manager or owner, we'll start our 23rd year. So I'm very excited about that possibility.
Did it take a while to build up a momentum?
Oh, yeah. I mean, basically, when you're in business, regardless of what you're doing, you know, after 3 years, we said, maybe it'll take 5 years to get this business up and running. At 5 years, we said, maybe seven. But it came eventually, and certainly, I've always promoted it as the premier dealer gallery in the Manawatu region and actually in the central districts. And we produced that. And it's been very fondly received by the public. We've had lots of folks over the years repeat business. We didn't have a lot of traffic from tourists because we don't get bus loads of people. If bus loads of people come into town, they basically come for dinner, take a sleep, and they're away, you know, at 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock in the morning to Taupo or to Wellington. So we relied heavily on making sure that what we were doing in quality of art, service, appraisals, picture framing was all aimed primarily at the local market.
And local rather than regional?
It is a regional market, yes, but concentrating on the 85,000 people that we have here today. And for me, that worked very well. I mean, it wasn't a gold mine, but it allowed us to travel. It allowed us to collect art. In fact, my wife used to say, well, you run a gallery surrounded by art every day, you won't need any more. But no, that's not true. When you get the opportunity to buy art at wholesale prices, and it's something you really want to have, that's ideal. So over the years, we put together a pretty good collection of
buying at wholesale price. So there's a wholesale market for art.
There's a wholesale market, but basically when the artist submits a work, there's a price that they want, and then the gallery puts its commission on that.
Yeah.
Well, as the gallery owner, I don't have to pay the commission. Yeah. I pay the artist what they want. Yeah. That's equivalent to wholesale. Yeah. But there also is a wholesale market among people who are developers of programs utilizing art, like cruise ships. Buy art wholesale to sell to people on cruise ships, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
That's a profitable market. But
is it difficult to identify taste and sort of see what would sell? Or
yes and no. I mean, what we tried to do was present the best quality art that was available within the wider Central District region and beyond. And that taste fell to me, my decision. In some cases, we took a punt. We carried things that I thought might not sell, but I thought worth showing. You know, and sometimes it would surprise me and fly off the walls. So you never know. You never know what people are interested in. And quirky things sell, as well as very fine art. We tried to keep the prices away from the Auckland market. If people wanted things of $100,000 paintings, we could source it for them, or we could send them. We had relationships with galleries in Wellington and in Auckland. And but for the most part, we tried to keep things reasonable. So, you know, $30,000 might have been the top end for majority of things.
So it was local artists to local buyers, basically.
Absolutely.
Or,
We tried to encourage people to get out of prints and go to local artists at basically almost the same prices, et cetera, or just a little bit more to get a real piece of art. And people understood that. That would last longer and increase in value more so than just simply a print or something framed from the warehouse. You know, they just would be decoration and become secondhand furniture.
So do you find people do actually buy for investment, or it's more they get something they like, there's a space in a wall to fill? Or?
Well, my philosophy was we're not really selling for investment. At the level we were selling at. A lot of people who buy for investment, at say $100,000 or more, often don't see the art. It's stuck in a vault in a bank and just sits there as a commodity. We wanted people to enjoy the art and to get to know the artist. So we had openings where you could meet the artist. We had tours to an artist gallery so that people could see what the artist was doing and what they were making in a full range of their art and get to know them. And this is what we encouraged. And that worked very well. I mean, still the way we would run the gallery is the artist is an important part of what we were doing and not just the provider of art or an object, but somebody who could communicate to the public and
And there's the story with it, I suppose, value.
Yep. Share that story. Share the hubris if necessary, and the trials and tribulations of of an artist. Yeah.
I suppose one of the most well-known names here is Paul Dibble. So is he?
Well, Paul Dibble was one of the first artists that agreed to sell through Taylor Jensen Fine Arts. Mm-hmm. Other than that, for the most part, he was represented by a gallery in Auckland. We handled Paul's work for 15 years. He ultimately took his work to another gallery in town, the Zimmerman Gallery, to help her get on a firm track to be able to pay the rent and that sort of thing, which was disappointing to us. But you know, the market is sometimes like that. It's fickle. We had other artists, etc., but not being able to sell the big expensive Dibbles, 95 to 125 thousand at that time, for which we would get a third. We were able to bank most of those and to have money in the bank to cover any difficulties. But, you know, Paul decided that he was going to have somebody else do it. He owned it. That's fine. Same thing with any artist who's has work on consignment. If they want to take it out and give it to somebody else, fine. We would not be happy if they sold it without us getting our commission, but you know, you deal with those things. But Dibble, people like Philip Holmes, Bonnie Sterrett, there are dozens. And
is it possible to make a living from art locally then?
Yes.
For the artists, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there are certainly a number of well-known artists in this area who do make a living. Continue to do well. I'm trying to dredge up those names from the back of my mind, but there certainly are people who do make a living. There are also lots of artists who do allied things, like they teach art. You know, or related things of that nature, and they do art when they can, and sell it to augment what they're doing as a full-time living. But certainly in this region, we have a handful of people who do make a living from their art, because their art is respected and desired.
Jack Register, I suppose, would he be?
Well, Jack Register decided in 1988 that his art was selling well enough that he would give up being a painter decorator and become a full-time artist, and he did that. And his father, who basically Basil Register, who had worked for the AA as a sign writer and sign painter, he made a living of his art. One of the things he used to do when they went out to put these yellow signs up for the AA is he would look at the scenery, make a sketch, go back to his studio and create a painting and offer that to the public. And Basil was a very fine artist and sold well. Jack, I am told, painted a number of pictures and sketches and things and then covered them with wallpaper when he was painting and decorating. So there are people, if you take the wallpaper off the wall, might have an original register. It's intriguing. But Jack, for many years before his untimely death, certainly was one of our foremost artists in this region.
Yeah, I saw him demonstrate how he could do a painting. One of those sort of in 5 minutes is a painting sort of structure.
Jack did a lot of what I would call art entertainment.
Yes.
He never really taught you how to do what he did, but he showed you and enjoyed the experience, and people certainly enjoy the experience of listening and watching Jack create, particularly his use of credit cards. for maneuvering maneuvering paint on the canvas. But he was amazing. He could make a painting, wipe it out, make another one. Three or four times during a demonstration, he'd do different paintings. He was very talented, clever, and delightful persona, and loved being with people, loved showing his art off, and I miss him.
Because it was only, was it about 2 years ago that he died?
Yes.
Not been, late. Yeah, been he came 2 years. From the UK and I think...
Well, I think he suffered from the thrombosis
from the flight,
as you get from long flights. Had a heart attack at home, took him to the hospital, had another heart attack, and they just couldn't do anything for him. Couldn't save him. It's a real loss.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. To the family, to the community, to the art world. Yeah, no question.
Yeah, yeah.
Was Frank Davis quite widely...
Who?
Frank Davis.
Oh, Frank Davis. Yeah, well, see, Frank Davis was gone by the time I got here, so I never knew Frank.
Yes, he taught me.
I knew Frank through Juana Davis, of course, I saw what he was doing. Majority of what he was doing was being an art professor, art teacher.
He taught me at teacher's
college. Yeah. He did some wonderful teaching and encouraging people into the art world. I don't think he was all that prolific, but if you have a Frank Davis on the wall, treasure it, because they're few and far between. And the city is fortunate to have a Frank Davis mural on the side of the city council building on the corner of Main Street. Right. And
which one is that?
It's the Roses.
Ah, okay.
Just on that corner of the square and Main Street, is a painting that has been retouched by Colin Hoare, but based on photographs taken of the original.
Because we now have a walking tour of a lot of the artworks, publicly visible artworks around.
Yeah, well, between the amount of public sculpture that the Public Sculpture Trust has put up, it's put us on a map as far as the source of art and the art that can be seen, and that's still being carried on.
Was it Barrowman's Lane? Is it was there? There was a whole series of walls.
Well, one of the things we had beyond sculpture, for the Sculpture Trust, and we're still doing, right now they're doing smaller things. The main Sculpture Trust has ended, but they've carried on, and they're going to be doing smaller, more human scale work, is I think what you'll see in the future. But we just recently had, within the last 6 months, a festival of murals, wall art, and all over town, there are probably 10 or more newly painted artwork to be seen and visualized on walls that would be blank otherwise. That you can walk.
I think we got Banksy you can walk and the that Bristol tour. Scene to thank for
yeah,
some of that.
You can see the sculpture. You walk around the
there's the Maori sculpture or the stone sculptures in the
yep there's the in the year 2000 we put together Prime Sculpture. In fact, Taylor Jensen Fine Arts was one of the sponsors, in which stone sculptors were invited to come to Palmerston North, work on a piece of stone of their choice, and it wasn't really a competition, it was just to create this environment to show people, and they've for 2 weeks people were carving, making dust fly. It was wonderful, and showing people how to do it. Folks had the opportunity to get with their hammer and chisel, or a mechanical device to chip away, etc. And at the end of it, the stones were initially taken to the Marae out at Rangiota, and they were there for about a year. And then when they redid the square one more time, they brought the stones back. And the stones are now permanently ensconced in the area
Was it the Something of Peace, isn't it?
Yeah, yes, yeah, so the daughter of peace.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a very special place, a beautiful sculpture.
Yeah.
And made by some of the best stone sculptors.
There's written descriptions of each of the items, but I'm not quite sure. It's not easy to you can't see it there. It's somewhere there's the record of what they all mean. But
If that doesn't exist, they probably should do something like that.
Well, there was some because there was they're starting the overseas sort of walking tour sort of things. That they've had a few that they're just doing occasionally here. Whereas in the tourist sites overseas, or places for tourists, you've got people who are doing that once or twice a day. So they get really polished and refined and all the stories come in. Whereas here it's more someone just looking at the notes and coming up with a basic description. It can grow from that, maybe. But yeah,
true.
So do you feel there's a lot of support for local artists?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You look at what's going on right now. Thermostat has reopened.
Thermostat Gallery.
Thermostat Gallery used to be on the first floor of the UFS building on the square. The building is owned by Simon and Catherine Ross. And they have now, because they had an empty space downstairs, instead of letting it sit there, they basically reopened Thermostat, which is a gallery aimed at supporting emerging artists. Square Edge, within this last year, put together a program of teaching art, Studio on the Square program. That has been very successful and is now, with the end of lockdown, has about to reopen. Square Edge has basically realigned itself again and moved offices. So they have the Square Edge office, and they have a shop, and they have a workspace. That workspace can be used by artists, or as we did last week, the U3A Art Appreciation 1 had its meeting there, the first since lockdown.
Yeah.
The space worked very, very well, and we're very pleased to have that space in the city. In addition, I think there will be other art galleries coming online. Snails certainly has existed for a number of years. It's an artist-run space. Mm-hmm. It's on the first floor above Pita Pit, and it again shows mostly emerging artists. Okay. It does openings and teaching and other things. It's a very exciting space run by artists, for artists. We have on George Street the George Street Collective, which handicrafts are displayed and produced. So that's another aspect of art. And talking about handicrafts, the art bombers, the yarn bombers, are out there covering pieces of sculpture and other things.
So knitting stuff stones and things,
Absolutely, that's an aspect of art as well.
What about textile art in general? Is that...
Well, textile art in general is alive and well. You just don't hear a lot about it.
Yeah.
This area was basically, I think... I wouldn't say a hotbed, but it certainly was a place where knitting mills and that sort of thing were creating patterns and artwork. Rusk and Finch, when they were in business, were doing some wonderful creations.
Lots of amateur quilters, I think.
Yeah. Well, you've got the quilters, you've got the embroiderers, you've got spinners and weavers. All these people. Yeah, and these lovely rugs that are in this room that I'm sitting at, just gorgeous pieces of work. Mm-hmm. And, there are other things coming online.
Yeah. What about ceramics? Because that's been up and down a bit, hasn't it?
Well, ceramics is up and down. We used to have a very vital Manitou pottery group here. We had a shop called The Vault, which at one time was within Square Edge, then moved out to Broadway. Now it really doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
But places like Taylor Jensen Fine Arts took over the selling of locally made ceramics. I think about anything. As far as textiles go in themselves, there's lots of things in that area. There's still exhibitions being shown in museums, the art gallery, etc., of locally created textile crafts. In 2015, we hosted the national quilting show, and I think we'll probably do that in a couple of years again, which brought a lot of people internationally to the city. It was so big it couldn't be housed just in the convention center, and you know, part of it was at our gallery, Taylor Jensen. Part of it was at Queens College. Part of it was at Girls High. So,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah. No. It's
yeah. There was a lot there.
It was a lot. Yeah. It was a big exhibition. So lots of things on the horizon, and you know, just watch this space. It's an exciting town for the arts, and like I say, I'm very pleased to continue to be a part of that as much as I can.
Yeah, I was going to say, now you've stopped with Taylor Jensen, you've actually got another project on that builds on your interest, haven't you?
Well, yes, but we won't talk too much about that. we hopefully have, like you say, the Schwarzenegger someday will be a real place, but I'm hoping right now, keep my fingers crossed, that the Taylor Jensen Fine Art comes back as a full-service gallery once again, and we're working to make that happen.
Yeah. I'll give you a mention, though, because you did say the word Schwarzenegger, and you're trying to collect Kiwiana.
Well, I have collected Kiwiana for 25 years.
Okay.
Basically, everyday Kiwiana, things that people make, use, import, etc., things that have become everyday things. I mean, you think about Kiwiana, you think of jandals, singlets, Buzzy Bee, Edmund's cookbooks.
But I know you've been collecting hangers.
I have been collecting hangers, yes. I've been collecting hangers for about 3 years.
So what's special about the hangers that you're collecting? If anybody's listening and they have some hangers, might there be things that you're interested in?
Hangers that are emblazoned with the name of a corporation, a company, a place, a dry cleaner, a dressmaker, a suit provider, you name it. I've been collecting them. I'm doing a history of basically, I guess, advertising on wooden hangers within New Zealand.
So they have to be wooden, not plastic? Or?
Well, I prefer wooden hangers because basically when they print on them, you can more easily see the text. But the wooden hangers go back to the early days of hangers.
So was that a standard feature then? Any sort of clothes shop would have their own hangers?
Or? Well, those who could afford it, or those who knew that if somebody took one of their hangers away, then other people might see it.
Yeah.
Or when they saw it, they say, oh, that reminds me, I need to go back to this place for another new suit. They gave away hangers for that purpose. It was advertising.
What about hangers crochet
covered by my great aunt? Well, we have a number of those in the collection, but you're right. You don't know what's underneath. But for the most part, what's underneath is lost one way or another.
Yeah.
But we have thin wooden ones. We have good bulk hangers. We have some made in the U.S.
With names, just New Zealand.
Well, for the most part, they're New Zealand. I'm concentrating on New Zealand. But some of the ones used here in New Zealand were actually made in the States.
Yeah.
And say U.S. made. But the idea basically is to document places that don't exist anymore.
Yes.
Through the history of the fact that they issued hangers. Mm. Now, Shaw Savile Line took tourists around, across the Tasman, etc. They had a hanger.
Souvenir hangers from people's holidays.
This is like your hotel towels and things.
Yeah,
you have to be careful about it.
DB, all the taverns and bars had many of them had hangers that advertised.
So a lot in your collection would essentially have been stolen from the businesses.
Well, I actually have hangers that say stolen from.
Yeah.
Because they knew that this was a piece of advertising. They weren't worried if they walked away.
Yeah, okay.
They encouraged. I mean, when you...
So the businesses actually wrote on stuff.
Yeah, when you bought a suit, they often gave you a hanger so it would hang properly in your closet.
Yeah,
and that hanger featured the name of the company you bought your suit from, or dress, or coat, or whatever. But if you went sailing... Hmm. On a P&O line, they often had a hanger, and they really didn't care whether you took it. They wouldn't say take a hanger, but often people did.
Yeah. Okay. Now, one more thing, because we're just about at time. Now, you started off through archaeology and so on. Has that aspect of your interest? Have you done any archaeology around New Zealand?
No, I haven't done any archaeology in New Zealand. I'm really not qualified in New Zealand because I don't know what the archaeological history is. I'm fascinated by it and read about it, but I'm not a practicing archaeologist. Mm. Some of the major precepts that we use in archaeology use worldwide, so that's not a problem. But I haven't chosen to practice archaeology here. We don't have enough archaeologists in this country. We've got too many places that are covered with parking lots before we could get to them, which is sad. But
probably the sciences is evolved a lot of that as well.
Well, the sciences evolved so much that in some cases you don't even have to dig.
Yeah.
You know, there's this lovely woman from the University of Alabama in Birmingham who uses satellite imagery to plot things. Absolutely marvelous. A whole series of television programs on the work that she was doing.
That's right. And they found also if there's periods of drought, then aerial photography, where there's been ditches, it's greener than where there haven't been and so on, so they can identify outlines of things.
Yeah, when I was doing archaeology in Pennsylvania, particularly in the Philadelphia area, the naval base at Whitewash, Pennsylvania, supplied me with a helicopter. And a pilot, of course, to be able to take aerial photographs to do that. Because one of the jobs that I was doing for the state of Pennsylvania was excavating the garden of an 18th century house. Mm. So taking photographs from various angles in different types of light with different types of film was all part of the initial study. And I couldn't have done it without the help of the U.S. Navy.
Yeah.
They were very, very helpful. They were intrigued. It gave them a training opportunity.
Yes,
for their pilots as well. So it was a good win-win situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent.
This is part 2 of 4. Listen next week for part 3.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you're a fan of NPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show.